Welcome to Red Alert Radio, grassroots radio with an ear on the issues that matter to you. Hosted by your local Labor MPs.
And good morning, it's Phil Goff, Labor MP for Mount Roskill, joining you on Red Alert Radio, Planet FM 104.6 this Thursday morning. Well, the week in politics to begin with. This week has been a recess week. Generally, Parliament sits for 3 weeks and has a week in recess. That, by the way, is not a holiday. That's when we work out in our electorates and catch up on some of the work in our portfolio or shadow portfolio areas. But Parliament hasn't been sitting this week, but the issues are still coming hard and fast. We've had, over the last week, the ongoing debate about the Iraq deployment. We learnt last week in Parliament that 143 New Zealanders will be deployed to Iraq, notwithstanding the Prime Minister's promise before the election was held that there would be no New Zealand troops on the ground in Iraq. Of those 143, 16 of them are going to perform a training function. The other 137 are simply troops in support and troops needed for protection because this is a high-risk operation. So 16 trainers, what difference is New Zealand going to make with 16 trainers? I've argued through the week that this is very much a token gesture. It's not about actually doing anything much more than sending a signal to other members of the club, as the Prime Minister has so delicately put it, that we want to be a member of the club and this is our joining fee. I'm totally against ISIS and I'd like to see far more effective action taken than what the Prime Minister is promising. And I've put out a couple of options that I think are really the way that we should be going. We've got a unique opportunity at the moment. New Zealand was elected at the end of last year to the United Nations Security Council, a role that we fill for 2 years. And we got a really good vote. We got the highest vote of any of the countries running in our region. And I think the reason for that was because New Zealand was seen as an independent country, a country that thought for itself. What, in heaven's name, does the rest of the world think when John Key says we're sending troops to Iraq because we want to be part of a select Western group of five countries, the so-called Five Eyes group? Well, let's use our role on the Security Council for a positive purpose. Let's use that role to press for the total isolation of ISIS. ISIS can't exist without money, without weaponry, without personnel. So what better to do in a leadership role on the Security Council than to push for closing off all of the avenues that enables ISIS to be sustained with new money, new equipment and new people? And secondly, if we're going to solve the problem of ISIS, it's not just ISIS. They are obviously barbaric and brutal in a medieval type way, but they probably haven't killed as many people as President Bashar al-Assad in Syria or Boko Haram in the Nigerian Chad area, or for that matter, the Shia and the Sunni militias, all of which in the Iraq-Syrian region have killed thousands, tens of thousands of people quite brutally, most of them civilians. If we're going to deal with ISIS, let's isolate the reasons why they are getting support. In Iraq, it's because the sectarian divide between Shia and Sunni, two different sects within the Muslim religion. The Shia currently control Iraq and they've been using their power to relegate the Sunni minority very much in an inferior position. And there have been attacks against the Sunni by Shia and against the Shia by Sunni. So we need to deal with the underlying problems if we are to remove the level of local support that the ISIS organisation is getting. And in Syria, we need to do something about a conflict in which Bashar al-Assad has killed more than 200,000 of his own people. They would be difficult to tackle. But unless we do those things, then we cannot succeed against the sort of extremist politics and with a religious label in this case that ISIS represents. And thirdly and finally, let's do something. If we're going to spend $65 million, that's the sum that the government has now told us they're committing to sending the troops to Iraq for a deployment over 2 years, why don't we use that to help some of the 13 million refugees who are facing a situation where they are poorly housed, particularly through the harsh winters, where they have poor medical services, where they don't have enough food, where it's very hard to sustain life. If we were to spend $65 million, we could make a real difference in that area, whereas trying to train an Iraqi army that the United States has spent literally $65 billion on, we're not going to make, realistically, any appreciable difference at all. So there's been the debate over Iraq. And of course, this week we've also seen the Privy Council decision, which has quashed the conviction of Taina Pora, something that most of us think should have happened some time ago, when it was clear that the DNA found on the body of the victim, Susan Burdett, was not that of Taina Pora, but rather of Malcolm Rewa, who has been convicted for multiple rapes and violence against individuals. It brings to mind another case, that of David Bain, and I'm not pretending to know whether David Bain was innocent or guilty. He has been found by the appeal court to be not guilty in the sense that there's insufficient evidence. But the decisions that are made in the last instance are taken outside of the judicial arena. They're made by the government, which is a kind of a contradiction for the separation of powers between the judiciary and the executive. There is what is called, and I looked at a number of cases when I was Minister of Justice, the prerogative of mercy, where the government can ask for a final court decision to be re-examined and can deal with claims of wrongful conviction and miscarriage of justice. That can be really controversial, as we saw in the recent decision by Judith Collins when she was Minister of Justice to decline to accept a report that said that David Bain was on the balance of probabilities not guilty and therefore was entitled to compensation. She rejected that and came up with another report that came up with the opposite conclusion. I think it's a mistake to have politicians making decisions of this nature. I think the far better alternative would be to have an independent criminal cases review commission that would decide whether a wrongful conviction claim should be re-examined and can also decide the quantum of compensation if a person is found to have been wrongfully convicted and imprisoned of an offence. That's what the Brits do, and I think it would be a good idea for New Zealand to follow suit. Well, lastly, there has been a controversy quite close to home from my perspective. That was a decision by the Remuneration Authority to give a reasonably significant pay rise to members of parliament and people on higher salaries, and that includes judges and other top civil servants. The pay rise was over 5%, when most other New Zealanders were lucky to be getting perhaps 1 to 2%. The Remuneration Authority, of course, operates independently, but this was a very hard decision to be sustained, and now the Prime Minister has announced that urgent legislation will be introduced and passed immediately, within a week, to reverse the Remuneration Authority's decision, to reverse the backdated salary increase, and to reduce that increase to what is more in line with others in the public service, about 1%. And that will replace the future deliberations by the Remuneration Authority on the criteria that they used in the past, which was to compare MPs and ministers with relatively similar positions in the private sector. Well, it's never a good thing for MPs to be involved in setting their own salary, even when it is to take it down. But I think the general view around Parliament was that that pay increase shouldn't go ahead at that level. And there are many of us that feel that top civil servants, some of the chief executive officers getting, you know, $500,000, $600,000, $700,000 a year, are also remunerated at a level that is beyond what traditionally we think a public service occupation should be given. $600,000 or $700,000 is, in my view, an excessive salary. I would like to see the top civil servants covered by a similar deliberation. And of course, in terms of the private sector, while we don't control what happens in the private sector, I think there are many New Zealanders that feel if you're going to have a salary, and some of them are, you know, $2-3 million a year, at the very least, we shouldn't have cut the top tax rate for really extravagant salaries, and that people on that level of income could afford to be paying more than the top tax rate of 33%. Anyway, those are some of the issues that have been occupying people's minds in the political arena over the last week. Today, I want to look at a quite different topic, and that is a bill that is currently before Parliament. It's called the Policing Cost Recovery Bill, and I'm a member of that committee, the select committee that's examining submissions on that bill, and we have been listening over the past 3 or 4 weeks to some really substantial submissions that are utterly opposed to the Policing Cost Recovery Bill. What this bill does essentially is to allow the police to charge for certain of their services, provided they believe that this is a demand rather than a core service. A core service is a service set out that under statute that police are required to do. A demand service, according to the police, is a service which offers quote unquote significant private benefit to service users, end quote. When this bill came into Parliament, at first, I thought, well, maybe this is, you know, Mick Jagger comes along, there's a concert, there's a heavy police presence required, the concert organisers are going to make $1 million out of it. Yeah, why not charge for those sort of services? On closer examination, the government's not planning to charge for those sort of services at all. Rather, they're planning to charge for services as yet undesignated, but the first one will be the police vetting service. The vetting service is where police look at the background of individuals that are going to be working in sensitive areas, such as providing services to children, to elderly people, or those such as the disabled who are particularly vulnerable. And through the week, we have been hearing submissions from a whole range of organisations, such as the Citizens Advice Bureau, the Cancer Society, Christian Social Service Workers, and so on, saying that this is not a smart idea, that this is not for private benefit, this is for the benefit of the community as a whole. I guess the debate comes down to the concept of user pays. Now, in many instances, user pays is quite appropriate. If you are using a service, then it's up to you to pay for that service rather than somebody that's not getting the benefit of it. But when we look across the board at core services like health, education, and policing services, then these are services that we regard as being for the community good as a whole. Therefore, they are properly paid for out of core revenue, out of the budget that we grant to the police each year, rather than for the individuals that might benefit from the process of the police providing services. So what our view on this, on the Labor side of the committee, is that we don't think that the direction that the government is going in is a healthy direction or is sustainable in any way. And overwhelmingly, the submissions that we are hearing from people coming before the Select Committee are in agreement that this bill should be withdrawn. Well, why do why did the government start moving in this direction in the first instance? And I think the basic reason is this. Over the last 6 years, the police budget has been frozen. So that what the police get each year is pretty much the same as they got last year, notwithstanding the fact that inflation has been adding costs to the provision of police services, and more the police are being asked to do additional functions on top of what they've been doing before. A clear example of this, and perhaps the reason why the bill is the policing cost recovery bill has come in at this time, is a piece of legislation that Parliament passed last year. It's called the Vulnerable Children's Act. That requires safety checks to be made of people who are working with children. Now, that's a matter of common sense. You know, we expect when we send our kiddies to school or to kindergarten or to early childhood care that the people who are looking after them are proper people, fit and proper people, to be carrying out that function. You and I both want to be sure that our children or our grandchildren are not going to be placed in the care of violent people or pedophiles or others that might damage their well-being, their safety. So, of course, we want those safety checks. And, of course, Labor and all of the other parties in Parliament supported the Vulnerable Children's Act. But this requires the police to do a considerable amount of additional work, and the government has simply not budgeted for the new role. They don't want to pay for it out of the budget. Mr. English, the Minister of Finance, is desperately trying to say that after 7 years he's got a surplus in his budget, and it looks like that this might not happen. So everywhere they can, the government is trying to either cut back services or find other ways of funding it. And in relation to the police budget in the last 4 years in real terms, that's after you take inflation into account, has been cut by something over $100 million. Less money, more demand on the services. What are the police going to do? Well, here we are. We'll pass a bill, as the topic, the title of the bill suggests, the Policing Cost Recovery Bill, that requires people to pay for more and more police services. Now, originally the idea was that it might be concerts or sporting organisations that would have to contribute. If they're having a big function, you know, the League Nines, for example, that was held recently, that's a big money spinner, and maybe the police services provided to a group like that could recover some of those costs. But the big sporting organisations objected to this, and consequently the government's backed right away from that particular angle. What they've decided to do instead is to pass legislation that is open-ended. They haven't said what are all the services that we're going to have to pay for. Those services will be added not by changing the legislation through Parliament, but by changing the regulations as to who is covered by the cost recovery provisions. But in the first instance, the government has said it will be the vetting services that will be charged for. Now, I think the police do something over 400,000 requests a year for police vets. And the biggest clients for this vetting service are community services, charitable organisations, caregivers, education, particularly the Teachers Council, the district health boards for health workers, and so on. Now, there is a process of softening up. I've got to say this government's very good at softening the public up to try to make palatable what the public don't really want to swallow. So they're saying, in the first instance, we're only going to charge about $7 for each vet. And you think $7? Well, you know, that's not too horrendous. Maybe we can cope with that. But when we've asked questions about what's happening in Australia, where they do charge for vetting services, we find that the bill is not $7 a vet, it's more like $40 to $50 for each vetting service provided. And there is a strong suspicion amongst the groups that will be affected that will start at $7, but very quickly that will go up to a much more substantial sum, and this will be taking large chunks out of the budget of organisations that are providing for community services. Some of them are charities, so the dollars that they get are dollars contributed by the public. The others, by and large, are government-funded services. So that means that the government will be charging itself, and it's a bit of a money go-round, but you've encumbered the system with a whole new level of compliance, so that much more of the money that's being provided will be eaten up with the bureaucracy required to administer this system. To me, it doesn't seem like this is a good direction in which to go. Well, joining me for the last part of the program today is my colleague, Poto Williams, who is MP for Christchurch South. East, I'm getting my geographic directions wrong here. Sorry about that, Poto. Poto was elected at a by-election when Leanne Dalzell stood for the mayor, mayoralty in Christchurch. And she has a range of responsibilities in Parliament, some of them relating directly to Christchurch, as you'd expect, with the aftermath of the earthquake, Associate Minister of Spokesperson on Housing, hopefully one day a Minister of Housing, and Associate Education Spokesperson looking at Christchurch schools. But the two areas that that are relevant to our discussion today are her roles as Associate Spokesperson on Justice and as the Spokesperson on community and voluntary organisations. Poto, welcome to the program today. I've interrupted you at Matatini, which is being held down in Christchurch for the first time for a number of years, I think, which is a good sign that the city is recovering from its earthquake trauma. But you've sat on the select committee with me, and you've heard the submissions from a whole wide range of groups that have come through. What do you think are the most compelling arguments that have been raised against this bill proceeding? Because I think it's fair to say, isn't it, that most people have been opposed to the bill. They think it's a bad idea.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And kia ora everybody from Matatini and Christchurch. And apologies for it has been a little difficult to get away from the festivities today, and there are thousands of people gathered in North Hagley Park to witness the start of Matatini. But thank you for that intro, Phil. You're absolutely right. The groups and the sector that I represent, the community and voluntary sector, have been very anxious to see that this bill doesn't proceed, because they're very concerned that the prospect of charging for police vetting will impact their ability to deliver services into the community. And the reason that they're concerned is that most of the community groups that I have spoken with either have some government contracts or will be taking donations from members of the public. And, you know, virtually all of the money that they raise or are contracted to government is used in the delivery of services for vulnerable populations, for, you know, many different groups. And we're really concerned that we are taking money directly away from the ability of these groups to do good work. So that's kind of been the first argument. The second argument really is around how these groups perceive the police vetting. Now, many of them I've spoken to in recent weeks, because as you know, we launched an e-petition against the bill. The community groups have been telling us that police vetting is the most important tool that they have. It's the most robust tool that they have to be able to screen people coming into the workforce. And recently, with the passing of the Vulnerable Children's Act, of course, it's become compulsory to screen, to police vet people working in the children's workforce. And not only that, but you have to complete that police vetting every 2 years or so. So you have to refresh every couple of years. So on the one hand, the government is saying it's vitally important for the children's workforce and for other vulnerable populations, the people that are working for them, to be police vetted. But then on the other hand, they're actually imposing a huge cost, not just in terms of dollars, but administration and time to these groups to vet people who are coming in to work for them. So the groups are saying very clearly it's really important to continue with the police vetting. It's their first line of defence, really, in screening people who are unsuitable and sometimes, frankly, unsafe to be working with vulnerable populations. So it's the first line of defence, and we are potentially taking money out of service delivery, really, which for an administrative charge.
Yeah. What they're saying to us, from the government side, is that these vetting services are for private benefit. In order to practice your profession as a teacher, you have to be vetted, so you should pay for it. And I guess they'd run that over into other organisations in the public health sector. But it's really a question, is this for private benefit? Isn't the major benefit from this actually the wider community and keeping our community safe?
Absolutely. And I know that our colleague Calvin Davis is very vocal on this because he has, he's very keen to ensure that people working with children in particular are appropriately screened and that screening is robust. Now, there are issues that come up when people are police vetted, and this is another argument that the community groups are saying, that if they know that there are that people that they are screening have a criminal record, they can then have that conversation about with that person about what that's about, because there are some people who have low levels of offending or who did some things that were a bit silly when they were young, who are still safe to work with, with our people. But at least we know that, and we can have an opportunity to have a conversation with people. When you don't know, when you make it very difficult, difficult and put up barriers to, the process, then people actually can sneak in.
Yeah.
And that's what we don't want. We don't want to inadvertently allow inappropriate and unsafe people to work with our vulnerable people.
No, well, that's absolutely right. I mean, I suppose the other concern that we've got is that this could well be the thin edge of the wedge for charging for police services. I mean, vetting is a core function, we would say. It's about crime prevention, it's about maintaining public safety and community support and reassurance. All of those are functions set out in the Policing Act, yet this is the first thing that's going to be charged for. But other things that they'll charge for later, without even taking it back to Parliament, could be a wide range of other things that we see as core services. And there's no real safeguards against that, is there?
No, there's not, because we know that once this bill has passed into law, then it just takes an order in council to then be able to charge for other police services. I mean, I've been very disturbed, and I know you have too, Phil, to hear the tone and the nature of the language coming out of the government members sitting on our select committee, who are really trying to diminish the value of police vetting to the community sector. And I'm very concerned by that, because we know categorically that it is a very, very important tool. And it is more than some of the language that our colleagues on the select committee have been using, that it's useful, but it's not vital.
There should be a warning in that. Hey, we've just reached the end of the program, Podo. Thank you very much for coming on, and sorry to drag you away from Matatini, and thank you for the great job that you're doing on behalf of the Labor Party down in Christchurch and the rebuild of the city. We'll catch up with our listeners this time next week. In the meantime, this is Phil Goff, MP for Mount Roskill, and speaking with Podo Williams, the MP for Christchurch East. Thank you for joining us on the show today.
Get together with your local MP next week at 9:05 a.m. Or listen online anytime on planetaudio.org.nz/redalertradio.